Blog Talk Radio.
Up, America, it's time to check your pulse. Educate, motivate, and activate. This is Pulse of the People with your hosts, Erica Collins and Stephen Jackson.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Pulse of the People, where we wake up Americans to fight for their democracy. It's Sunday, January 12th, 2020, coming to you live from New York, New York. I'm here with our legal moderator, Stephen Jackson, and the bell has rung for round one on our match for democracy. So, Stephen, what's the debate from the blue corner to the red corner?
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Pulse of the People. This is Stephen Jackson. Well, I'll be talking about the status of the impeachment of President Donald J. Trump. Should Nancy Pelosi refer the matter over to the Senate, where, for all intents and purposes, if there is a rigged process, the fix is guaranteed without witnesses? Should she pursue that avenue, or should she go in another direction? I'll also be discussing the situation over in Iran, in addition to the assassination of Iran's top general, Soleimani.
And tonight's guest is Michael Hardy, Executive Vice President and General Counsel. He has been a practicing attorney since 1988. He was admitted to the bar of the state of New York, each of the New York State Federal Districts, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court of the United States. In 2008, he officially assumed the position of general counsel to the National Action Network. Michael Hardy, along with Reverend Al Sharpton, are co-founders. He has been involved in movement politics and the fight for a more perfect union since 1981. Also, he serves as Al Sharpton's personal attorney. Welcome to the show, Michael Hardy.
Thank you. And it's great to be here. And I got my finger on my pulse to make sure that I can keep up with you.
Sounds good.
I'm sure you will.
So let's take a travel back into time to the social justice and political climate that inspired you to begin the journey of NAN, the National Action Network.
Well, you know, I think I was inspired on my journey in terms of social justice and a more perfect union way back when in my childhood. I always remind people that I was born in 1955, which means it was exactly 1 year after this nation had and the Supreme Court had issued a decision in Brown versus Board of Education. That decision officially ended legal segregation and discrimination in this nation. So on many respects, you know, I was in that first generation of Americans who were legally citizens of the United States, in terms of quote unquote having full rights. And, you know, even though growing up in the North, my grandparents were in the South, and whenever we traveled South, you could immediately, you know, once you got into Baltimore, frankly, you could feel that you were in a different place and that things were different and that there were different rules. And, that taught me at a very early age that, that things were not equal, and that there was a lot to be done, again, to make this a more perfect union. So I've been on this road for a long, long time.
That's an amazing historical perspective. I'm quite sure Stephen wants to talk about today's climate.
Sure, Michael. Just to piggyback on your history and your challenges as a civil rights attorney, what was your most difficult challenge as a civil rights lawyer once you became the prominent attorney that you certainly have become? What's been your most difficult challenge?
That's a tough question, actually. I mean, I think, you know, every day really is a challenge because you have to, as you said, you have to keep your pulse to the ground. You've got to know what's going on. And, you know, in many ways, I've had the benefit of being a part of and connected to the work of Reverend Al Sharpton. And, you know, we are on the air in terms of connection 7 days a week through radio. Reverend Sharpton also does a national show. So it's constantly knowing where our people are at and the things that need to happen. And the challenges happen on so many levels. I mean, you know, we suffer environmental discrimination. Obviously, we suffer legal discrimination. Obviously, we suffer from educational discrimination. And so the challenge is making sure that you're doing the things to constantly renew yourself so that you can remain, one, healthy and committed to a movement that victories are sometimes far and few between. And it is a commitment that is very difficult and challenging to maintain because I've seen people come and I've seen people go. So being able to stay the course, so long as there is an injustice anywhere, we will be on the field to try to ensure that there's justice everywhere.
That's true. The road to justice is a long, winding road, Michael. That's for sure. Just to bring you up to date, what is your thoughts about the current impeachment status of President Trump? What are your feelings on that?
Well, listen, you know, I you know, hear and respect the criticisms of people with regard to this president. You know, impeachment is a process. The people that run that process believe that the president has engaged in acts that are impeachable, and they're following through on that. Obviously, it's a Senate that doesn't that's a Republican Senate. You know, you have a Democratic Congress, a Republican Senate. And I think the interesting thing here is over the last 20 years, we've seen a new kind of extreme partisanship that I think is enormously hurtful to the country. I mean, sometimes people will reflect back on the Clinton impeachment. And when Clinton was impeached, there was, in fact, a Republican majority in the Senate. And that Senate, after hearing the evidence that was presented, acquitted Bill Clinton. The issue now is whether or not there really can be a fair hearing, and many people are questioning when this impeachment is actually handed off to the Senate, whether there will be a fair and impartial hearing of the facts in the United States Senate.
Well, how do you feel about Nancy? I'm sorry, Erica, you want to join in there?
No, it's okay. It's interesting because everybody keeps comparing it to the Clinton era, but on the eve of the Senate having the information, they don't have all the same information that they did in the Clinton era. Isn't that correct?
Well, when you say the same information, I'm not sure what you mean.
There's
by
no
that.
Witnesses.
Well,
the
I
way
mean,
the
we don't know. I mean, I don't look. I mean, I think that's a big part of what Nancy Pelosi was attempting to accomplish by withholding the transfer of the impeachment from the House to the Senate, because right now, at least from McConnell, the Senate is essentially saying that there going to, in effect, act in a summary judgment type of manner. They're going to take the facts that have already been developed and make a decision on those facts without witnesses. There are many, including some Republican senators, that have begun to stand up and say that that may not be a fair process for the people of this country, given that the Congress has voted impeachment. And so the process, if you will, is that, you know, the party in control really controls it. And so we're really at the mercy of the Republican majority to see what really happens in terms of the actual trial in the Senate.
Well, doesn't that certainly justify Nancy Pelosi's course of action in this case? You certainly, as a practicing trial attorney, you can analogize the impeachment process to that of a grand jury and an ultimate trial before a jury. Now, the House having voted for articles of impeachment, that would be tantamount, would it not, to a grand jury indictment, and would further require additional proceedings and additional witnesses and evidence in order to bring about a fair and complete trial. And so wouldn't the Senate be obligated to, in fact, pursue additional evidence and most certainly put on witnesses who are relevant and have relevant testimony and certainly who could provide some light on what appears to be a slew of crimes and misdemeanors committed by this president?
I don't disagree with that. I think that would be what you would expect from a trial. I think the issue is that, unfortunately, the way the Constitution is written, the Republican majority controls that. And if they make a decision and got the votes to sustain it, that they can act basically in a summary judgment type fashion where they take the facts that are at hand and make a decision on it. You know, there's no, you know, the interesting thing about the Constitution is it did not, other than John Roberts presiding as the presiding judicial officer in the impeachment process, the Supreme Court itself has no role. The Supreme Court cannot review any decisions or lack of decisions that are made in this process. And that is unfortunate, meaning that, again, it will, whatever happens will happen at the will of the Senate. And the point that I was making in trying to compare it to the Clinton era is that, you know, there was, in that time period at least, there was a more flexibility. The mere fact that it was a Republican Senate did not, in essence, interfere with the perception, at least, of Bill Clinton having the opportunity to have a fair hearing and a fair trial in the United States Senate. And in fact,
well, there was more.
Senate voted to acquit him.
Right. Well, during the Clinton impeachment, there was certainly more adherence to the rule of law and the principles of the Constitution. And we unfortunately don't have that kind of commitment today from the Republican-controlled Senate. Now, you mentioned something.
Right, and my point, Steve, is that is because of the extreme partisanship that we now,
the nation has just
become so divided that in these areas where you can control it, just like the Republicans denied Barack Obama as president of the United States his absolute right to appoint on advice and consent a nominee of his to the Supreme Court of the United States.
True.
Right.
What do you say to the younger generations in the division who keep ranting, oh, he wasn't really impeached? How do you get that message across to them that historically, at this moment in time, President Donald Trump has been impeached? And the question now is going to the Senate for removal. How do you phrase that?
Well, I mean, you know, I would have to say that, you know, history will determine that. I mean, if Nancy Pelosi transmits the articles of impeachment, it will be in the Senate's hand. and they will have to have a trial and a process that determines whether he is convicted or not convicted, and if convicted, whether he is then voted to be removed from office. And, you know, so I think it's too early to really speak on that. We've got to see what happens, you know. And I think for young people, I think the part of the lesson is to look at this type of partisanship and realize that participating matters, voting matters, because the more active we become as voters and the more competitive we can make political office, particularly on the federal level, the more likely we may be in a position where you have situations where every elected official has to pay attention and adhere to the interest of his entire constituency as opposed to just the gerrymandered part of his district.
Do you think, Michael, under the current circumstances, considering the polarization of the parties, do you think it would be a fair strategy for Nancy Pelosi to pursue additional articles of impeachment in the Congress relating to additional charges of other crimes and misdemeanors? For example, Trump's violation of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, his obstruction of the Mueller investigation, allegations of sexual harassment, the charity foundation scandals, his campaign finance violations, which resulted in his attorney serving the federal time, nepotism allegations. Do you think, as a matter of sound strategy, do you think Nancy Pelosi should, in light of the Republican Congress, Republican Senate's recalcitrance, should she pursue additional charges in the Congress?
Well, let me answer that in two parts. I certainly think, and many people think, that there was evidence in the Mueller report and others with regard to obstruction of justice and other acts that you just outlined that the Democratic Congress certainly could have looked into, investigated with regard to their process in terms of deciding what the articles of impeachment are. There are those that argue that, you know, that the impeachment could be held until after the election to see whether he's reelected or not, and then begin the process of amending the articles of impeachment and going forward. So again, you know, the Congress, the House of Representatives, really, the ball is in their court with regard to what the articles of impeachment are. They chose to do the two. That was their vote, their decision, their deliberation. Do they have the right to change that? I think they absolutely have that right, so long as the articles are not been transmitted to the Senate. I think they can add to that. You know, I'm not aware of any procedural issues that would prevent the Congress from amending the articles of impeachment prior to them transmitting it to the United States Senate. Of course, it would require the Congress taking the necessary votes and you know, all of that.
So moving to another hot topic this week, Iran. Stephen?
Yeah. Donald Trump unilaterally decided to take out the number two man in charge in Iran. He ordered, in effect, an assassination of an important Iranian General Soleimani, without consultation from Congress. Michael, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think the action of ordering what, in effect, is a hit against a world figure without consultation with the Congress was inappropriate?
Well, again, you know, you know, I can't. Was it inappropriate for Barack Obama to unilaterally decide when, once they had the information, to assassinate Osama bin Laden? I mean, you know, the presidential powers, the executive powers, the right of the president to act in these situations is pretty well established. Now, again, you get into the politics of it, and it's a different story. And I understand that there are a lot of people that are saying that the president's act to kill the general in light of all that's going on is a more dangerous act than to not have killed him. On the other hand, there's no one that disputes that the acts of the Iranian general in terms of his past and present intentions with regard to America are that he presented a clear and present danger. So, you know, I sometimes think about, you know how they say that there's a saying from The Godfather for every situation. And, you know, there's that scene in The Godfather where Al Pacino and Diane Keaton are walking and she says, well, but Michael, you know, your father, you know, kills people. The president of the country doesn't do that. And Michael says, well, who's being naive now, Kay?
Wow. How do you feel about what just came out saying that there was not, or they did not see any evidence of the plot against the United States embassies?
Well, again, I've listened to some of the national shows today where some of them were saying that there and that it's well accepted on some levels that there was sufficient evidence that the general had plans. And again, that more broadly speaking, that the general's intent in general is well established. And then I understand that there is some conflicting interest. And look, the intelligence community is one that the president has attacked, which really shocks a lot of people. And so, you know, in this really partisan environment, again, where even the president and the intelligence community itself are at odds with each other, you know, I mean, unfortunately, it's just it's just so much out there that we have no way of knowing what's really true and not true, frankly.
Yeah, but he can't have it both ways, Michael. He can't on the one hand say, well, you can't trust the intelligence from the United States intelligence sources with regards to Russia's interference in our elections. But on the other hand, okay, we can fully trust so-called American intelligence with regards to the threats allegedly made against our embassies. And again, I have yet to hear a scintilla of evidence supporting that allegation. And quite frankly, the timing of it is very suspicious in terms of trying to obstruct and obfuscate Trump's own problems with regards to impeachment. The context of the multitude of misstatements and lies that he's made during the course of his tenure. So it's very difficult, I believe, for most rationally thinking Americans to think that there was any legitimacy behind the idea that the general represented an imminent threat and a clear and present danger to the United States. And all you've got to do is look at the reaction and the response from our allies, or maybe I should say our former allies now, who certainly are not supportive of this president's current course of action in Iran.
Yeah.
And
I would say that if you look at the most recent polling on these issues, that there is a majority of people that agree with your perception on that.
Okay.
And
well,
it's also,
overall, the Americans have a lot of anxiety about both the impeachment and Iran. Pulse of the People is not just a podcast. It's a call to action. Stephen, what do the American people need to do this week with impeachment and Iran?
Well, you know, with regards to impeachment in Iran, I think the American people have to stay vigilant, pay very close attention to what their political leaders are saying, the course of actions that they are embracing, and become vocal, voice your objection to what's going on, activate, agitate, and certainly vote. Look, under President Trump, the climate crisis is accelerating. The national debt has ballooned. Hate crimes have exploded. Brown kids and moms are in cages, dying. Racism is out in the open and out of control. Our nation is being destroyed by a corrupt, narcissistic idiot. So certainly there is a dire call to action that we all, as good citizens, must urge our political leaders to act responsibly. Enough is enough.
Michael, would you agree with that plan of call to action?
Well, I definitely agree with a call to action. And what I specifically believe is that, look, we are at a critical stage in the history of this country, in the future of this country. And there is an election that is going to happen in 2020, in November. And not only that, but there's also a census that is going on that is going to determine where the congressional districts are, where the money goes into communities. And the only way to have some impact on that is to exercise your right to vote. I think people forget, and that's where I started, people forget that in this nation, people lost their lives, they shed their blood, they went to jail in order to ensure the right to vote to every eligible citizen or every citizen in this country. And I think, again, when you think about your daily lives, who represents you, what kind of resources are in your community, what your schools look like, all of those things require and are determined by how people vote. So your vote matters. And you may not realize that every day, but it is essential that people participate, that people vote, that they register, that they pay attention, that they learn about the candidates that are purporting to represent them on every level, including the President of the United States. And I think in many, many ways, the future of this nation will be determined, at least on the national level, by who is elected or not elected in the upcoming elections in November of this year.
Thank you, Michael Hardy, so much for being on our show. We know that you and the National Action Network will continue to be a great success, and we look forward to watching you fight for our justice.
Hey, well, we're always on the front lines, no justice, no peace, and we try to keep the pulse of the people.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Pulse of the People on Blog Talk Radio. Remember to check us out on Twitter for more information to be a guest or a sponsor.
This is Pulse of the People.